Well, good evening and welcome back to the Journey Home program. I'm your host, John Mark Grodi, here on EWTN. And once again, we have this great privilege to come together to hear a story of faith and conversion. We're joined tonight by Amanda Martin. She's a former Episcopalian. And this is a very special episode because just last week, we had her husband, Father Doug Martin, on the show to tell his side of the story of growing up. What was he originally?
Methodist
and then Episcopalian, dabbling with Calvinism in there. And then he met Amanda, and we heard a little bit of that story. But we're excited to get the rest of it because there's a lot in your own journey in terms of your theological background, your own journey, your own side of this whole story of a Protestant pastor becoming Catholic and all that discernment and everything. So we're so excited to have you here, Amanda, to tell you the rest of the story.
Thank you. It's been a long time coming because, you know, we followed the show for 20 whatever years it's been. And so it's exciting.
Yeah.
And, I feel like his side is probably more theological and mine is more emotional to tell. But I guess I'll start with, I grew up Southern Baptist, actually, in the South. And I was the youngest of four children. And I had three older brothers that were much older than me. My parents had me late in life. So kind of grew up feeling like an only child, kind of very quiet and shy. And I feel like to tell eventually my conversion story, I have to give a little background with my mother and our relationship, and to hopefully do her justice because, you know, God rest her soul, she's not with us anymore. But she battled mental illness my whole life. And that strongly comes into play later on in the story. So, but from all outer appearances, I was very close to my mother. Everyone assumed we were very close. And I felt kind of the pressure to be the perfect daughter for her. So I tried not to cross her. We walked on eggshells a lot. So and she would be hospitalized at times. And so our church attendance was sporadic. But in all of that, my mother was a staunch Baptist, you know. You had to be Baptist. And even though we didn't always pray in our home and read scripture, you know, it wasn't always necessarily practiced, but we were. We were Christians. We were Baptists.
Did she grow up Baptist?
She grew up Baptist. Okay. Actually, her mother was Nazarene, and all of her, my grandmother's side of the family is still mostly Nazarene. So she liked to tell the story that she actually finally was rebaptized as an adult, kind of felt that pressure to become Baptist, to be one with her husband and family. But, and so like that was a point to kind of prove that, see, being Baptist is the right way. But anyway, so between the ages of like 7 and 12, I loved Jesus already. I loved going to vacation Bible school or Sunday school and, you know, hearing the Bible stories, and I knew I loved Jesus. And then I would hear, you know, as a Baptist, you're supposed to heed the call to be saved, to say the sinner's prayer and be once saved, always saved. And I would, you know, hear altar calls, especially if it was geared towards children at vacation Bible school or something. I'd raise my hand. I wanted to say the prayer and be saved. But my mom had different, I don't know, idiosyncrasies about it that, no, you're not ready. You're not ready. You're not old enough. Even though other people, it wasn't a set thing in stone. So we had, you know, other friends might have done it at 7, but I wasn't allowed to. So finally, when I was about 12, our church was having a week-long revival. And I don't know if that still happens today, but the Baptist church has always had these, you know, week-long revivals that they have guest preachers come in and guest musicians, and it's very hyped up, and we have potluck every night, and it's just a good time. And I looked forward to those. But of course, part of that revival was also trying to get as many people saved as possible, sort of thing, Billy Graham.
Yeah.
And so at one of the nights, it was a particular hellfire and brimstone sermon, and I remember he asked, if you died tonight, do you know if you'd go to hell, heaven or hell? And of course, that scared me because, you know, I thought, well, I love Jesus, but I don't want to go to hell, you know. Mm-hmm. And so I was crying, and my mother happened to be there that time. And I looked at her, and she was ready to help me walk down the aisle, say the sinner's prayer, and get saved. And then shortly thereafter, to do a profession of faith baptism, which is what they do, a believer's baptism, because it's just a symbolic thing of what you have done, you know. And so, which I was deathly afraid to be dunked because I couldn't swim, but I got through it. So there, that's my core young adult faith. But I did always feel like I had a strong faith. I've never doubted God. And with all the chaos going on with her illness and yelling in the house or chaos, I really had a deep interior life with Jesus. And it did, I did have a conversion moment there where, you know, I did start reading scripture every day and, you know, I wanted to go deeper in my faith. And so, but I know there were many nights that I would imagine, I had a vivid imagination, and I would imagine myself crying at the feet of Jesus, just that comfort through those hard times. So that's the setup of my base faith. When I got into high school, again, I was very shy, and I did date one guy, but we broke up because I couldn't talk to him. I just was so shy. And then I did have one good guy friend who happened to be Catholic, and it was completely platonic. He was just a good friend, but my mother was so nervous that it was going to turn into a dating that she warned me, you can never date a Catholic because you can't marry a Catholic because they're not Christian. And that was really my first introduction to being Catholic. I really didn't understand or know what Catholicism was at that point, but I just now knew it was wrong. And every once in a while, you'd also hear in like a sermon, them rail against the Catholic Church, you know, that it's that, you know, the whore of Babylon, they worship idols, all those things. So that was my, introduction to Catholicism. And also my brothers had those chick tracks that were so horrific and would even, you know, they would try to scare you into hell, but, you know, to get saved. And it would include the Catholics who needed to be saved, you know. So that was my view of Catholicism. Right. It was taboo. It was wrong. I don't know exactly why, but it is. So I continued in high school going to whenever the church doors were open, I was there. And even if my family wasn't going regularly to church, I got a ride or I got there one way or the other. I wanted to be at church. I wanted to be at Sunday school. We did Wednesday night, Bible study, youth group, everything. And so we went through a few different youth ministers through my high school career. And one of the last ones when I was a senior just took us really deeper into Bible study. I just started like taking lots of notes and I just was eating it up. I wanted knowledge and I wanted to go deeper. And so it turned out, and I didn't know this really at the time, that he was Calvinist. And there is that sect in the Baptist church, really the roots kind of started with Calvinism. And not everyone knows that, but you know, that there's the Calvinism or you are, or you're not in the Baptist church. And so of course our church, they didn't want that. So they kicked him out. Well, I was missing that deeper Bible study. I mean, he could take the exegesis of a scripture like I'd never heard before, you know. And so he ended up doing a young adult college Bible study with another friend, and I ended up transitioning over to that. And so what I liked about it, again, was that it went deeper. It also would mention, you know, older scholars, which meant like Spurgeon or someone. I still know really not a lot of early church fathers. I had not heard much about any early church fathers at that point. So during college, well, first of all, I'd always planned to go off to college, do the dorm life at the college my dad went to and my brothers went to. And my mother convinced me to stay home and help her because of her poor health, which I say is the best decision I made and the worst decision I ever made, because the best because I ended up meeting Doug because of it. And the second, you know, because she couldn't really cut the apron strings with any of us, much more with me being the only daughter. And so it was funny. So we, like I said, we had a surface relationship and I walked on eggshells. So if I, sometimes I would try to, you know, share things with her, and her way of trying to control things that she didn't like was, might be harsh, it might be criticism. So I might date a guy, and I always wanted someone in ministry, because that's, I always felt like, well, that's someone who's really going to be deeper in their faith,
right.
You know. So I dated someone who was a gospel singer, and then eventually, the last guy I dated in my junior year was going to be a Methodist minister, but she would always be critical and say little things about them and my choice. And so finally, so the last relationship with this Methodist friend, he had been a good guy friend, and I had been lonely, and I saw all my friends around me were dating. I wouldn't have a ride to go to the hayride, so he'd give me a ride. And so I just ended up sort of forcing a relationship there that I knew wasn't right. And most of the time in relationships, I just would know right away. I'd have red flags, or I would know there was no chemistry there, but I would have a relationship anyway because I just didn't want to be alone. Growing up, you know, as a Baptist, you didn't have the sense of vocations.
Right.
So the religious life wasn't an option. And it was always that I wanted to be married and have a family, of course. But we did have a few single missionaries. There's the famous Lottie Moon, who was a missionary to China and Baptist. And I really liked her. But I always thought, oh, God, but please don't make me single like that. I can't do, you know. But when I had this relationship with this guy friend, and finally, I hated myself, and that I was always not listening to God's will, and I was ready to be done with it. And the summer between my junior and senior year of college, I swore off dating. I surrendered to God. I asked him to forgive me. I just said I would rather be alone than unhappy with the wrong person and not in God's will. And that was a defining moment for me. And so I shared that with some friends, especially also during this time I was attending the Baptist Student Union at the college, because they had a weekly Bible study. A lot of my friends went there, and we would have a luncheon at noon once a week. So that's me going into my fall, the senior year of college. And everyone knows this. And so one of the first Wednesdays I go for the luncheon, I walk in the door with my best friend. Of course, I'm late as usual, but I walk in the room and instantly I realize someone's there. And I kind of catch his eye and he catches mine. And so I'm nervous. And okay, we eat, we listen to the speaker. And it was Doug, of course.
Yeah.
At the end, they sort of did the Baptist thing where everyone swarmed around the new guy. Who are you? What are you? Where are you from? What do you do? And what was funny was he had one of those Mexican Bajas on that's like a hoodie that made him look like a missionary. And I was thinking, wow, who's this? You know? And I heard him say he was from Alabama. And I said, oh, I'm from Alabama too. And which wasn't exactly true. what had happened was I was, my whole family's from Louisiana, but my dad had been transferred when my brothers were young, and we lived a total of 16 years in Alabama where I was born. When we moved back to Louisiana, it was during my brother's high school years. He hated leaving his friends, and so he was always just had a negative attitude about Louisiana, and we were out big Alabama fans. So I was proud to say, I'm from Alabama too. So that went kind of won him over even more for me. Yeah, imagine my family lived in Alabama and we'd be close, you know. So anyway, I had to leave, go to work, and it would end up being 2 weeks before we saw or talked again. But he asked people after I left, who is that? What is her name? You know, and they were like, oh, that's Amanda, but she's sworn off dating. She doesn't want to date. And, you know, she just wants to be friends. And he was like, well, I'm not looking for a friend. So, when I got back, when the next time I was there, he came up to me and we talked a little bit and he asked me to, you know, go to coffee or something. And I was like, well, I'm not doing this dating thing and he's a stranger. So no, I'm not going to go anywhere with him. So I gave him, I said, why don't you call me, you know, and I gave him my number. Well, that started everything. That was, like he told you, you know, he was not going to, here he is going to an Episcopal seminary at that time. Right. And I'm a Baptist girl. He knows that's, there's going to be trouble. Mm-hmm. So he wants to avoid that issue. But I immediately, okay, first thing, so you're Episcopal, why do y'all baptize infants? That was my first question I wanted to know. Because I had kind of started looking, exploring that idea with my Methodist friend. I felt like I didn't get good answers. Mm-hmm. I went to a Sunday school teacher to get the Baptist view, why, and I didn't feel like I got good answers. So that's kind of where I was at the point that I met him.
Well, and Doug shared that he had, in his internal dialogue had been, because he was so enthusiastic about theology and he was working through these questions, that he had been planning, like, I got to reel myself back.
Yeah.
And I don't want to come on too strong about the theology. And then you dropped the question
on
him.
No, let's do this. I want to get into this.
Delightful.
Yeah. So we started a phone relationship, just talking hours and hours. We were both working and going to school full time. So we never slept. We just talked and talked for hours and hours, getting to know each other, but a lot of theology. And he opened my world. He didn't just give me, this is what I believe, or this is what my church teaches. He opened up the world to the church fathers. He started showing me where this was done in the early church, right after Jesus left, right when the church is growing, the early church. Why? What happened between that and the Reformation? Why did we get rid of that? So that opened up a whole new world for me. And because that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to absorb it. I wanted to go to the original sources. I wanted to see, you know, what I wanted. I was seeking truth.
Yeah.
So that's where I was when that's how things are escalating.
Yeah.
And here I am living at home. And my mother is seeing this begin to happen. She doesn't know how much we've been talking. So we have our first date in November. And we decided, I told my friend, okay, well, I'm going to scare him away. I'm going to say, I want 10 kids and a big wedding. And like, that's going to scare him away. Well, he was like, okay, you know, sure. And that didn't work. So, but I think when I came home from that first date with him, I think my mother finally realized she's smitten with him and this is going somewhere and I've got to stop this. Mm. And that's when kind of all hell broke loose with her and her harshness and trying to prevent this from happening because it's wrong. And I called Doug and I said, are you sure you're ready for this? Are you ready for a fight? And I use that against him now. In years past, I've said, I warned you. You know, you had plenty of warning. But he was ready. He was ready for it. And so things continued to escalate. We ended up getting engaged in March. And so there were two times my dad stood up for me. Now, he was the classic enabler, this sweet gentleman. He's still alive. He's in assisted living. He's 89 years old and finally a deacon, a Baptist deacon now. He's just living his best life, and I'm so glad for it. But two things he stood up for me was he went and talked with Doug and gave him his official blessing to marry me. It is an official act, you know, that he wasn't happy with the situation, but he just wanted to know that he was going to take care of me. You know, they talked a little bit. And, you know, my mom wasn't happy about that. The other thing was, so things were, again, escalating with my mom, and it was a fight every day. She was lashing out, trying to stop this from happening and being critical of Doug. And one funny thing she would say is, well, he's going to be a minister. He doesn't even sound like a preacher boy. He doesn't say, praise the Lord and amen. You know, like, no, you don't have to do that. But there's just a lot of conversations where she just like couldn't understand how I would change my beliefs like she'd always taught me. And that I tried to explain a little at that point, well, you know, that there was things I couldn't talk to you about because of your harsh criticism. I couldn't open up to you. And I think from the, I want to say that because from the outside, I think a lot of people, family and friends were like, wow, but they were so close. Did that, did Doug coerce her to do this? And no, it wasn't like that at all, but it was just a surprise. That was the only, it was the first time that it was worth standing up to her, you know? And it was, I never doubted my decision to marry Doug or to do what we did. So in May, as things had escalated, and coming from her mental illness, she wrote something on paper that was threatening, mostly to herself, but she left it where it was in plain sight so I could see it. And, you know, I had to be open with Doug and share this. And she went out of town with my father, and we shared this with my brother, and we shared this with spiritual advisor. We'd been doing marriage prep, and everyone said, you've got to get out of the house. This has become not a safe situation, and what do you want to do now? So I moved in for 2 weeks with my best friend and her family as we planned our own wedding in 2 weeks' time. And we weren't going to invite them to the wedding after that, with this threat hanging over our heads. But my brothers convinced me, you'll regret her not being there, and we'll make sure she behaves, you know. And so last minute we went and we invited them. And, you know, my mom said a few things, but my dad said, no, I'm going to walk her down the aisle. That's my daughter. So that's the second time he stood up for me.
Yeah.
And so he did. So we start walking down the aisle, and immediately we hear wailing, loud sobbing, very dramatic. She falls back in her pew, and just, you can't imagine it. It was, at one point it was on video, and somehow that videotape got lost over time, and we're fine with that. Some of her grandchildren witnessed it. I'm glad that my kids can't hear it. But we just plowed through. I just looked focused on Doug, and I kind of got down to the end of the aisle and was like, are you sure you want to do this? And absolutely. So we just plugged through, and yeah, it was a beautiful, powerful moment despite that. Everyone who attended our wedding said they'll never forget it. And, you know, that was that. We began our happy marriage, and never got an apology for that. But we did continue to maintain a surface relationship. We tried. I think still somewhere in the early years, I had hope that she would maybe change and be apologetic and be a more loving about this. You know, it was just, she could not handle that I made a different choice than she would have, you know. And so
Yeah.
That was that.
Well, let's take a little break there and we'll come back.
Okay.
And again, it's just, you know, I'm struck by, you know, you, one of the things that it seems like you met in Doug was a fellow searching soul, you know, someone mm-hmm. who desired the truth, wanted to ask the hard questions, wanted to keep pursuing.
Yes.
You know, and that led through this difficult experience, though, of discernment and choosing marriage and exciting. And there's more to go in the story.
Yes, a lot, yes.
So we'll be right back to hear the rest of it. Again, we're joined by Amanda Martin tonight, and this is sort of a second part episode because we talked to Father Doug Martin last week, and we're excited to hear the rest of the story tonight. So we'll be back in just a couple minutes to hear more. I want to remind you, though, if you are someone who's thinking about becoming Catholic, you know, if you're asking questions, if you've met someone who you're having these kinds of discussions about theology, we'd love to accompany you on your journey. We'd love to pray with you and for you. If you go to chnetwork.org, we have a newsletter, we have retreats, we have an online community, but most especially, we have other converts who've been through what you're going through and who'd love to talk to you, to hear your story, and just to help you in whatever way we can as you proceed on your spiritual journey. So check us out at chnetwork.org, but we'll be back again in just a couple minutes to hear the rest from Amanda, and so we'll see you then. Welcome back to the Journey Home program. We're entering the second half of our hour tonight, speaking with Amanda Martin. She's a former Episcopalian. She's married to Father Doug Martin, who was an Episcopal priest. We talked to him last week, and as we heard in his story, he has since, they've become Catholic, and he spent some time discerning, but he is now an ordained priest in the Diocese of Pensacola-Tallahassee. So we're having a great time tonight hearing the rest of the story, the other side of the story. We left off, Amanda, you had this difficult experience, you know, in terms of family, but, you know, meeting Doug and striking this great friendship, this great relationship, and then persevering and discerning and becoming married. And so we'll pick it up there. What happened next?
Yeah, so he was ordained Episcopal priest. You know, part of also deciding to marry him and become an Episcopal, too, and I was confirmed in the Episcopal Church before we got married, and I fell in love with the liturgy. And had the beautiful liturgy of the 1928 prayer book that I romanticized because I was a British literature Jane Austen fan, and this was just perfect, you know. And the music was beautiful, and so that all fit.
It was very different from what you grew up with.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah, liturgy. It was. Yeah. And so I loved it, and you know, he became a priest. We moved to El Paso, Texas, and he started his ministry, and we had our first child. Going back, my mom, one of her arguments about marrying an Episcopal was that it was just one step away from being Catholic, and she ended up being right. Of course, as he told you, we got involved in ministry there, and he was seeing a lot of moral issues, things that weren't backed up by his church and church teaching, and dilemmas there. And then at the same time, his best friend, who is a theology major he'd gone to school with, is deciding to become Catholic, and they are hashing out the going deeper with those theological arguments. And every night on the phone, long conversations, I overhear, I'm tending to the baby, and I'm just, theology's not number one on my list anymore. You know, I'm just busy with being a mom. But I'm hearing him say these things that really sounds Catholic, and what's going on here? And that kind of escalates to the point where, you know, one night he comes to me and he says, I think I need to be Catholic. And I'm like, what? I mean, just so many things race through my mind. I mean, I feel angry because, like, I just battled this, and you know how much harder it's going to be. Like, I'm going to I'm going to be disowned. And then also it's just wrong, right? That's what I always learned. And it's taboo because this, I don't know why. I don't know why. So I finally said, okay, just give me something to read. You know, that was my go-to. And I knew, you know, again, I could dive into the early church fathers and find the answers. So I read Rome Sweet Home. I listened to all the Hahn tapes that he mentioned. It wasn't that he hid those from me, but he was himself been, you know, trying to squash that. So right. It just wasn't forefront in our anything that we talked about. But so I listened to the tapes, listened to Janet Smith and understood, you know, pro-life and contraception.
Yeah,
and
the theology of the body type
yes,
stuff.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. Okay.
And that was like the first thing to go immediately. And then, what's some of the other books? Surprised by Truth and, you know, Your Father's Story and all of those. I would read their story and relate to their arguments were. And then I would take it to the early church fathers and I would read it. And every issue would just started falling by the wayside. Like, that makes sense. That makes total sense. Like, of course, that's so obvious, you know. But it was still taboo, you know. It was still but it's the Catholic Church and the Pope, you know. And so it came down finally to that main issue of authority. When I looked at, there's over 40,000 different denominations. And this one believes they were led by the Holy Spirit to believe this, and this one believes this. And the splits even in the Baptist church are, you know, every mainline church has so many split offs.
Right.
So who has the authority? Who's right? And when I read that upon this rock, I'll build my church, and Peter was the first pope that oversaw the council that, you know, led to apostolic succession and the magisterium and 2,000 years worth of teaching that the core basics had not changed and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. And that was it. That's what did it. I could rest in that. I didn't have to worry about all these little issues. The church has already worked it out. And it was almost like if you've ever gone to one of those youth camps that does the trust fall, mm-hmm. it's like just falling and trusting. You know, it's like a weight lifted that I didn't even know was there. Yeah. And so so that was it.
Yeah.
He was not wanting to convert without me, but willing to. And I thought, I'm not going to be divided, I finally got there, you know, and so we were ready. And then he entered the process for the pastoral provision. So at this point, I knew what was going to happen. So I wrote my family a letter to explain what we were doing. And the response back, the letter I got back from my parents and my mother's writing was, I don't have a daughter anymore. Mm. And so I was disowned. And it was painful, but I guess, you know, that's what I expected, really. I didn't have much time to process that because we moved. And like he said, I think he told you this. We Southerners who moved far away from family and friends to this, in the middle of winter, Northern Illinois, to an English basement that, you know, the windows are at the ground level, but you can't see out because the snow is so high. And then it was so small that all of our stuff was packed to the ceiling. So it was like a little dungeon. And then I had a miscarriage with our second child. And that was so painful. And, you know, as a mother, you question, did I do something wrong? And we didn't have anybody there really for support. And also, you know, I had a one-year-old, and I wanted to go to La Leche League meetings and meet moms, but we really weren't supposed to kind of talk about why we were there. We kind of need,
because
you know,
he was in discernment,
yes.
Sort of working with, yeah, okay.
Yeah. And I guess not to cause scandal, you know, until it's a done deal.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, we accepted that, but it made it very hard.
Yeah.
And now my Doug got on the phone and called my mom and said, you need to talk to your daughter, you know, because she's suffering. And so She did, and she comforted me as much as she could, and so that undid the disowning. So, you know, nice. I feel like our story theme is always beauty from ashes. You know, we go through a time of suffering, and then there's beautiful things happen. So, but still a surface level relationship with her. But that was okay. We just, so we coasted, but he decided to step out of the process, and we felt like we just needed to be Catholic for a while. You do all of this theological study and you're convinced of it all, but the actual living it out is another thing. I mean, I think that's a good thing why RCIA is a long process, because you get to go through the seasons and learn, you know, what are the traditions and, you know, of the seasons.
When you guys had the added layer to all this that many people becoming Catholic don't, which is that, you know, you had been looking for a pastor, you know, when you were thinking about who you would marry, and you met him, and you did ministry together, and you were there. Becoming Catholic means in laying that down. So there's a certain identity crisis that comes that.
For both of us. That's true. Because even in the seminary, we took some classes, and we learned how to be good priest wives. Right, you know, I could do altar care, and I could do this or that. And so it's like, now, where's my place? Right. What is my mission? Right. You know, what? Yes, to take care of my children. But beyond that, I didn't know. And so, so he gets out, he looks for a job, gets a job, but 9/11 happens. We lose that job. We move home back to where we were living by my parents, and he gets an old job back. And this is just several years of kind of wandering. We have another child. And, so then we're at the point where I'm expecting our third full-term baby. And, because of my complications and having C-sections prior, I ended up having what's called a uterine rupture, and we lost Noah as a stillborn, and I died on the table, and I had a near-death experience. That whole pregnancy, too, had been one of the most beautiful spiritually. I had, come into being a Catholic, and I really dedicated it to Mary. I prayed the Divine Chaplet with EWTN every day while the kids napped. I mean, it was just, everything was perfect. And then that happened. But she was there with me through the suffering. So I died, and I had this experience where I actually recognized people, but I not by name. Like, I couldn't say, there's my aunt who died, or there, but I recognized faces, and this pulling, this tugging to the light. And while over here, I knew they were working on me. I didn't know what they were doing or what that meant, that they were doing chest compressions. I just knew they're trying to save my life. And I was having this internal dialogue because I was suffering. I couldn't breathe. And I thought, they're prolonging my death. Just let me go. I didn't want to die, but that was my immediate thought of release me from this pain. Anyway, so I finally have this one thought of Doug and the two kids, Micah and Jillian. And that's when I am back. Like, the next thing I remember, I have tubes down my throat. And it was a long, painful recovery, and just so much happened with that. But Doug, had his own suffering to go through, that knowing that his son had died and that they were working on me and didn't know if I was going to make it. And so when I started to, like, the first, I couldn't talk with tubes down my throat, but I would write notes about what I saw and experienced. And one thing that Doug stood out to Doug, because he had read St. John of the Cross, and he wrote Dark Night of the Soul. And that was so defining for that moment. So at that point, we hit rock bottom. We lost our home. He lost his job. We lost our son. We lost my fertility. Dream of a big family. And we found out something else that my parents did that was very hurtful. And I won't go into that, but I couldn't handle it. I was done. So I cut them out of my life at that point, because I couldn't, you know, heal and deal with that at the same time. So it was several years that I wouldn't talk to them. They kept trying to send letters and things, and it was a very painful time. We moved back home to live with his parents, and just to heal. We just had to heal. And I don't know how people get through things like that without their faith. And knowing, you know, I felt closer to Jesus than ever through the suffering, and closer to the Father, because he knew what suffering and losing a son was like. And so, this was a very dark time for us, but also a very bittersweet time of just healing and growing in our faith, being loved and nourished by his family. His family was Methodist and loved us unconditionally, and just so there we are. At this point, after a few years, we had the blessing of being able to adopt our daughter, our rainbow daughter. So it was more healing, more wonderful. We ended up, my brothers really worked hard to do remediation with me and my parents. My mom, unfortunately, during that time, she'd gone through ovarian cancer, and I missed all of that. And I know that she just really couldn't understand. She couldn't understand how her actions had hurt me and all these things. She couldn't bring herself to apologize. But, you know, I went to confession and talked to the priest, you know, and I had to forgive her to have peace.
Yeah.
And so that's what we ended up doing. We went back into a situation where a surface relationship, I can't trust her. I'm not going to leave my children with her. I don't trust her. So, but we had a relationship at least. Okay, so this brings us to, we're back to Doug's home city area, and, you know, we live with his parents for a while, and then we're able to get back on our own 2 feet. He's working in just a regular job, and he's miserable. Like, he doesn't even really realize it.
Yeah, he mentioned that. Yeah.
Yeah.
You probably did.
But I did. He was miserable, and he was a pastor at heart, and that's what he said. I heard him say, I, you know, said something about, I wasn't pushing him to go back to the pastoral provision. I knew that something was missing from his life, that he needed his heart. He had the pastor's heart. He needed to see what he could pursue. And that was when the youth ministry position opened up at our church. And we began that 10-year process of doing youth ministry together, and that was a wonderful time of our lives. And it just really, and I encourage all adults to get involved in youth ministry, because you're going to learn as much as the kid is, maybe more. And we, you know, loved going, taking them to camps and like Steubenville conferences, and our souls would be just as fed. And it was just a wonderful time. And it's really special, because now he's gotten to actually do the marriage of several of his kids that were in his youth group over the years, and that's been really beautiful. But so when this all came up with the pastoral provision and the idea of him stepping back into it, I was like, yeah, it's about time. And so it was kind of, he said he never got a no, but he, it was a long wait. You know, once we told people what we're, this is what we're doing, we're discerning this, and this is going to happen, it then it dragged on, and people would all keep asking us, is it going to happen? When is it going to happen? Well, you know, we have to wait on Rome, you know. And, but it was, after all of that, though, the waiting was always worth it. We are right where we are supposed to be. We have a wonderful bishop, wonderful parish, just a wonderful life, you know. And it's, like I said, our theme is beauty from ashes. We went through some tough times, and other people do too, and I feel like it just helps me to empathize, you know, with others and what they've gone through. And it's been hard to find my place. People always ask me, what is it like being a Catholic married priest's wife? It's hard to define that, to say, because there's nothing written about it. I mean, there's nothing, no protocol, you know. But I liken it to when I helped him with youth ministry all those years. And our kids were up at church all the time, and that was our life. And that's our life. We want to be there when the church doors are open, and I want to support where I can and fill in where I can, and I'll do the flowers or the plants, or I'll, you know, cook in the kitchen, or, you know, hospitality, altar care, whatever. In youth ministry, I work with the middle schoolers now, and I love it. And so I don't know that I can have one answer that says what it's like to be a married priest's wife. Yeah. It's similar to being a Protestant minister's wife, but different.
Right. Well, in your guys' case, you can just God's loving providence in that, you know, it's the right place, it's the right state for you, mm-hmm. you know, in terms of both of your souls and what you loved and what you had a passion mm-hmm. for. Mm-hmm. And so we praise God that, and again, in this providence, that it's worked out the way it has.
Yeah.
What a beautiful story. We have about 7 minutes left. Yeah. And so just, you know, a few things for us to circle back around on. You know, one is, again, that theme, and that's a beautiful theme, beautiful articulation of it, this beauty from ashes. Maybe talk a little bit of just of what you... Because certain Protestant backgrounds don't have a real... They don't know what to do with suffering, right? Yeah. They're not sure what to make
right.
of it.
That's true.
Talk a little bit about what you encountered in the Catholic Church that maybe helped you at least be able to process that
I know you have certain sects that think, well, if you're suffering, you're not in God's will. It's like something must be wrong.
Right.
And others just don't know what to do with it or say that, you know... That's a beautiful part of our faith, is that there is beauty in suffering, that you can offer it up as a prayer. You can unite that suffering with Jesus on the cross, and with Mary's suffering, watching her son go through this. And there's so many beautiful prayers and traditions that we can pray and, I learned when I became Catholic, I learned so much about mercy. Mm. You know, just one small, tiny example is the getting rid of the death penalty, the idea of that. I mean, I feel like I gained so much mercy and empathy for others. But yeah, suffering is a part of love. I mean, love can be suffering, long suffering.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I think about, you know, when Christ tells us to pick up our cross and follow him.
Yes.
Well, so we know life has crosses. There
right.
will be crosses.
Right.
The question is whether it's, so the church is helping us to like recognize, well, internally, something has to happen for us to engage with what's happening externally. Like, right. crosses are going to happen. That's part of the result of original sin and yes. just the nature of the world. Right. But if we turn to it,
yes.
and as you said, unite it with Christ's suffering,
yeah.
then great beauty can come out of the ashes.
Right, right. And one last thing, I'm always trying to find my place. What is my calling outside of motherhood? What else? And I ended up recently finding out I've always been called to Carmelite spirituality. Oh, yeah. I just didn't know it. I go back to my childhood and think my vivid imagination when I imagined that I was at the feet of Jesus, and I can identify with St. Teresa's interior castles.
Right.
And then the dark night of the soul. And even at times I look back and know I was resisting Carmelite spirituality because I would meet someone who had invited me to go, who wasn't a friendly person and I didn't like very much or didn't want to be around. So that was my idea and I kept pushing it away. And that's another thing that he has brought full circle on all along. I've been called to the vocation of prayer. I always said I wanted to be like my mother-in-law, who, even though she wasn't Catholic, she was a prayer warrior mm-hmm. and, wrote everybody's name down in her prayer journal and yeah. prayed for you by name. And the beauty of Carmelite spirituality and the prayer in the internal life is... know what to say about it. It's just, I always thought I could never follow a rule of life because I'm just too unstructured and that's too hard and it would feel burdensome, but it doesn't now. The Carmelite rule is just, and praying the liturgy of the hours is, it's, again, I can just rest in that if I don't know what to pray, I have those prayers every day united with prayers all over the world.
Yeah.
Everyone praying those. And that's been a beautiful calling.
I love the Liturgy of the Hours as well. And I think of it in terms of there's a connection between praying the Psalms and the Catholic's theology of suffering and how do we understand it. Because yeah. on those difficult times, sometimes we don't have the words.
Right.
And so we need the words of Scripture.
Right.
We need the Psalms. And sometimes yeah. when we're having a good day, we need to read those sad Psalms.
Yes.
And remember that in the body of Christ, other people are suffering.
Yeah.
So I'm praying with them.
And even, I think of Mother Teresa and the days you don't feel like praying, but you do them anyway. And you're still going to learn something. You're yeah. still going to be brought back around to Christ and what you need.
Well, we just have a couple minutes left, and so mm-hmm. just a last comment here. We've touched a lot of things, but again, we have a special heart for pastors becoming Catholic and their spouses and mm-hmm. their families, because again, there's all the theology stuff. There's yeah. that side of it, but then there's this vocation. There's this identity mm-hmm. side. There's really a white martyrdom that happens.
Yeah,
That they have to lay down so much.
That's
and so,
true.
If there are those out there who are mm-hmm. in the midst of that process, or they've gone through it, mm-hmm. or pastors and their wives who are considering it, a word of just encouragement and love to them on the journey.
You just keep seeking and asking God what He wants you to do. What is His will for your life? What is your mission? I didn't realize and resisted a calling to the Carmelites for so long because I wanted more to do. I wanted to be more involved, but I don't get involved in his priestly duties. And, I'm just there to support. So it is hard to find your place, but you just keep pursuing it or find something to do in what your special gifts are. There is a place for you. And the church has been very receptive. They always have looked at us as a package deal and been loving about that. There are a few that, don't know what to do with me, yeah. don't know, they're not sure about it. But for the most part, everyone is welcoming. I do emphasize when people say, oh, maybe this means the church is changing their teaching. Well, no, this is just the exception to the rule. and we're not trying to change it. I actually say I'm going to write a book, and one cover is going to say why Catholic priests should be married. Mm-hmm. And then you flip it over, and the other side says why they shouldn't be married. Because there's definitely difficult things in it. You know, it's not the same as being a Protestant minister. It's different. Mm-hmm. But you keep pursuing what your calling is and what your mission, and it may be a quiet calling, or it may be something big that you can do, but there's something there for you.
That's beautiful, Amanda. Thank you so much for sharing your story.
And
thank
you.
A wonderful note to end on, just that reminder that, you know, beyond the surface level, you know, we can only see so deep. The reality is that everyone is on a journey.
Yeah.
God does have a plan.
Yes.
He has a plan for your holiness, to draw you into his glory, to sanctify you. Like, it takes patience. It takes pushing through some suffering sometimes. Yes. But he has a plan.
And I'm closer to my mother now than I ever was because I'm praying her out of purgatory and we talk. So or I talk to her.
Wonderful. Well, let's keep praying for each other and for our dearly departed.
Yeah.
Thank you for being here for this episode of the Journey Home program. I pray that Amanda's story was an inspiration to you. Be sure to catch last week's episode as well to hear the whole story of Amanda and Father Doug. Just a wonderful story, wonderful reminder of God's love and his providence in each of our lives. So we'll be back again next week with another story. But in the meantime, God bless and be with you.